Good morning. This is Brad Lacey, pastor of First Baptist Church at Conshohocken, president of the Philadelphia Bible Society, a ministry of the free distribution of God's life-giving word. And for this hour, as always, it is my pleasure and privilege to serve as host of the great message on Talk Radio 1210, WPHT. My guest is an ongoing and most welcome one, Mr. Matthias Pertula, who is the advocacy director for, I believe, Southeast Asia with International Christian Concern. Matthias and I will be discussing the plight of our brethren in Afghanistan and across the globe. But first, we tap into Paul's letter to the Philippians, Philippians, the fourth chapter, and quite simply, the eighth and ninth verses. Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things, what you have learned and received and heard and seen in me. Practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. The Apostle Paul is speaking to a small group of Christians. They are part and parcel of the church at Philippi, and they are one of the churches that Paul himself has established by his own labor. There are any number of churches throughout the Eurasian world that were established by Paul, and if not established by him, in the very least, he had apostolic authority and oversight concerning them. And he had a love and regard for each and every of these churches. Truly, there were some that gave him grief. He loved them no less. But in Shakespearean style, not that he loved any of the others less, but simply that he loved this one even more. We read in the very beginning of this chapter, he addresses the Philippians, and I quote, as my joy and my crown. Paul clearly had a deep and abiding affection and respect and agape, that is the love of Christ, for these believers. I understand, as best I can, I pastor a very small church in Conshohocken, but I wouldn't trade my small fellowship for a mega church's pastor of 10,000 souls. I have a deep love for my people, and they in turn have a deep love for me, and we give glory to God as he blesses us and honors us with his presence and uses us in his service. It matters not the size, and Paul clearly established this principle early on. My joy and my crown, as he addresses this small aggregate of believers, I would strongly suspect even smaller than my own. And to this group, he encourages them, he wants the best for them, and therefore he encourages them to cast their minds and their hearts and their aspirations, and yes, to apply their bodies to things that are worthy and things that are beautiful. And therefore we read of such qualities as whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there be anything worthy of praise. The apostle is encouraging his joy and crown to cast their souls and their lives upon these things. We looked a couple of weeks back at what it meant regarding whatever is true. And for what time remains, I would like to examine what it means vis-a-vis that which is honorable. And I first encountered radio within the context of an honor system. It was in the fall of 2008. My wife and I were in Kennebunkport, Maine, right where the Bush family has a magnificent estate along the Atlantic Ocean. And as we were parking our car, I'd received a phone call from a man who was the sales executive at a local Christian station. I had worked with him as far back as 1992, when he asked me to share two 45-second sermons over the radio in conjunction with the Billy Graham Crusade, again of 1992. I was very intimately involved with that crusade, and it was my pleasure to offer these messages. 16 years later, the gentleman calls me and offers me Sunday mornings at 8 a.m., a half-hour slot. We would provide edited versions of my sermons. But what was interesting of the moment was that I was moving to pay for my parking fee, only to discover that it was an honor system. I would put the money in the box, or I wouldn't put the money in the box. If I didn't, no one would be the wiser for it, but I certainly wouldn't have been the better. Thank God, by His grace, I put the money in the box. I spent 2.5 years sharing my message and our gospel over that small watt station. But the gentleman running it left the station to come to Talk Radio 1210. And in 2016, he reached out to me, and I graciously declined. It just wasn't the right time. He reached out again in 2017. I guess I was as gracious as I was before, and I declined. He came back to me a third time, and I've learned over the course of my ministry that when something comes calling three times, it invariably has the imprimatur of God's hand and will upon it. And I'd like to think all because I chose in 2008 to be honorably rather than dishonorably disposed. As I turn to the Oxford English Dictionary, we read of honor. It speaks of high respect, esteem, deferential, admiration. One can only think first and foremost of the mother of our Lord, Mary, the Virgin Mary, when the angel Gabriel visited with her. And we read of this account in the Gospel of Luke. Angel Gabriel greeted her, and he says, "Mary, you who are highly favored of God, highly favored of the angels, now down through the centuries, highly favored of both Catholics and Protestants, notwithstanding the fact that we may have some fine-tuning differences with one another on the subject of this beautiful lady. But for anyone to have been chosen by God to carry the baby Jesus in her womb, to bring him forth into the world, and to raise him up and nurture him, this must have been an honorably disposed, honorable woman. Greetings, Mary, you who are highly honored before God and the angels." The OED, or Oxford English Dictionary, also speaks of honor being that of nobleness of mind or of spirit, and of magnanimity. I can think of no one more magnanimous, notwithstanding his quirks and kinks of character, than the great Winston Churchill. Churchill stood alone between the darkness of Nazism and the brightness, if you will, and airiness of Western democracy. He stood alone for 2 years, knowing he didn't have much more than that, the kind of pall that hung over him. And yet to those who were his political enemies, and they were legion throughout the course of the 1930s, upon his ascendancy to power, he reached out to his enemies. And in his presence, he never allowed anyone to speak ill of any of those men who had heretofore been derisively opposed to him. Indeed, he elevated many of them into positions of honor and of power and of importance. If anyone in the history of Western civilization was magnanimous other than Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, it was Winston Churchill. But if we return to the OED, or the Oxford English Dictionary, we read that that which is honorable speaks of that which is upright. And to be upright means to stand erect and to stand forth or stand out. And John Calvin, the great Protestant Bible expositor, whatever one may think of the particulars of Calvin's theology, no one would question the greatness of his expositions and of his expository instincts. And Calvin says of the Imago Dei, or the image of God, that humankind expresses that image, not simply in terms of its moral compass or its intellectual capacity or the like, but even physically with our bodies, because our bodies stand upright, they stand erect before God in a way that none of the other animals do. Even the closest approximates to us amongst the primates, gorillas and chimps and the like, they don't stand completely erect as do men and women. We are called to stand erect before God and the world. And as Paul spoke to the Philippian believers earlier in his letter, he told them that amidst this corrupt and depraved generation, that they were to hold forth and shine like stars in the universe as they held forth the word of life. God's people are to be an upright people, morally, spiritually, ethically. They're to pay their parking fees when there's an honor system. And I pray of my own life, as I pray of that of my congregation, that we be expressions, as I pray of every single professing believer, that we be embodiments and expressions of the honor that is to be had as a people and the children of God himself. Praise the Lord. Brad Lacey with the great message. We return in a moment. Brad Lacey returning with the great message on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT. I am simply delighted, as always, to invite and to welcome onto the broadcast Mr. Matthias Pertula, who is the Advocacy Director for Southeast Asia on behalf of International Christian Concern, a marvelous ministry by way of practical support and lobbying before governments of the on behalf of our persecuted brethren. Matthias has become a dear friend. And Matthias, welcome back to our broadcast.
Well, I'm honored to be here as always, Brad. Well, thank you for
it's a delight, truly. We get along famously. And I have always had a deep and abiding heart for our persecuted brethren, as clearly you do, and those who work alongside of you. So, Matthias, catch us up to speed, please, with what is playing out in Afghanistan, and especially amongst our Christian brethren.
Yeah, so I'm sure everybody's been seeing the news, or most of us have been following the pretty tremendous events that have taken place there, especially since the beginning of August. The first 2 weeks were especially chaotic. I think things unfolded in Afghanistan quicker than most would have expected, although there was a lot of varied opinion on how things were going to transpire there, especially with the Taliban takeover. But I think by any stretch, it caught most of us off guard. They took over the country lightning speed as the United States withdrew alongside several different allies. They kind of proceeded by taking over the provincial states and capitals, eventually taking over Kabul in August 15th, I think it was the official date when Kabul fell to the Taliban. And since then, that really sparked the massive run on the airport. Just scores and scores of Afghan civilians, Christians, religious minorities, people that we were working with directly, trying to get off the ground, trying to get through the gates at the airports, onto planes and out of that country before the Taliban really took over. That lasted for about a good solid 2 weeks, that very, very difficult time. And then as the United States completed the withdrawal, we began to see a little bit more, or we're beginning to see a little bit more of a settling of what's becoming the new norm. And what we've seen is the Taliban has secured complete control in a very hard line segment of the Taliban, which is the Haqqani network, essentially, that's taken complete control. They appointed an interim government, which is all Pashto members, which does not have any reflection of the diversity of the ethnic backgrounds of people and groups in Afghanistan. It is a militant, an oppressive regime that's been taking over. And any hope of receiving some form of a reformed Taliban to take over the country has, I think, all but faded. I don't think we're going to see that. And that's generally agreed upon through most of the networks I work in with.
Well, Matthias, let me ask you this. If one goes back to the era of Churchill, when the Allies declared war on Nazi Germany, for the next 6 months, there was what was called the phony war. Nothing much was happening until the Nazis decided to make further encroachments upon Western Europe. And so my question to you is, and I guess it's hoping against hope, but right now we understand the pall that hangs over our Christian brethren there, the fear that must fill their lives. But is it quiet right now, or has the Taliban begun to make an insidious move against the church?
I'd say it's begun to make the insidious move. If anything, there's maybe a little bit of a lull in the intensity of it. Certainly, when they were first taking over the country, we were getting reports immediately of Christians receiving phone calls from what we believe to be Taliban, and you know, threatening notes, threatening letters, threatening calls, you name it, all kinds of different things. And it wasn't just Christians, obviously, that were getting the brunt of it. There were many others that were getting similar threats. I mean, women's rights activists. There were several counter protesters against the Taliban that took place in Kabul and other places that were just pretty brutally put down. I mean, we had images just even recently of the Taliban whipping women, whipping the protesters in just grotesque manner, essentially just quelching any kind of opposition to what the Taliban stand for. But I was talking to some of our contacts earlier, and we've seen a little bit of a lull in it, in the attacks, but that's partly probably due to the fact that the church is very scared. They don't want to be even taking phone calls or, you know, being in touch with folks like us. It can be dangerous, and they don't want to have any kind of exposure to any kind of threat, any kind of situation that might cause even more threat on the church. So you can just imagine the fear.
Well, Matthias, the very fact that they can receive these phone calls is not simply suggestive. It's categorically the case that the Taliban knows where our brethren are with great specificity. And I recall hearing about a week back, there was someone in the West was on the phone with some Christians in Afghanistan, and they were being assured that the Spirit of God was in a very visceral way coming upon them and giving them a boldness. And then it was articulated that our children have assured us that they would not deny Jesus. And no sooner did that get articulated than there was all manner of gunfire. And one can only conclude that that beautiful family was martyred and taken to heaven. Are you hearing stories like that ongoing?
Yeah, there's scores of stories similar to that. All kinds of things that we're hearing from there. But I think the big takeaway from that is, you know, the church is not going to leave Afghanistan. It's going to stay there, and it's going to endure because the Lord has a plan for Afghanistan, and the Lord wants to use the church in Afghanistan to reach people and to proclaim his kingdom, to proclaim the gospel, and we're going to be there to support it every step of the way.
And Matthias, I run the risk of being or sounding glib. I'm sure you know me well enough. It's not my intent. It may very well prove to be the case here in the West soon enough. But as the great Tertullian once said from the ancient church, the blood of the martyrs is the seedbed of the church. And so whatever hell reigns against our Afghani brethren, and thank God for folks like you and agencies such as ICC seeking to be in the very least a palliative, the reality is that Jesus went on record. The gates of hell shall not prevail against the church. It will not prevail against our Afghan brethren, even if many of them meet the Lord sooner than they anticipated.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, we've seen that even in places like China. The more they try to clamp down on the church, the more it grows. Yeah. There's nothing that they can do to clamp down the gospel. This is the message of God, and it's not going to get clamped down.
And Matthias, all the more, drawing upon my earlier homily All the more Christians in the West would do well to be leading with great intention and earnestness, godly, honorable lives, rather than being sucked into the vacuum and vortex of all manner of depravity. But that being said, Brad Lacey and Matthias Pertula, we return in a moment. Thank you. Brad Lacey and Matthias Pertula. Matthias is the Advocacy Director for Southeast Asia on behalf of International Christian Concern, a watchdog ministry and a ministry of practical support on behalf of our beleaguered brethren around the world. And Matthias, with all of the focus cast upon Afghanistan as of late, the sad and rueful reality is that the plight of Christians elsewhere in the world remains in play as well. So I'd love to hear from you, and you identify whatever regions or situations or cases that you're led to offer, but share with us what's happening elsewhere in the world. And I strongly suspect, and I wouldn't bet against it, Nigeria comes into the discussion.
Certainly does.
Yeah.
Certainly does. Unfortunately, Nigeria has actually trended even worse than it has over the last couple of years. In fact, our team just visited there a couple of months ago. And on the road, one of the nights that they were traveling, just within an hour of them passing by a certain village, there was a horrendous kidnapping that took place just as they had passed by that particular location. And that area has known to be a fairly safe area in Nigeria, but it goes to show how the violence and how the kidnappings and just the lawlessness is starting to affect the more secure areas around Nigeria. We've actually just put out a report on Nigeria. We published it today, and I welcome anybody to go look at it on our website. Highlights another case that we've been tracking very closely, which is the fact that 12 northern states in Nigeria, which is predominantly obviously a Muslim section of the country, has Sharia law criminal courts, essentially, that, you know, have extreme jurisdiction even over non-Muslims. So this means even Christians are subject to the penalties of Sharia as they see fit. And they exercise a lot of control, and it's just, why am I bringing this up? Because it's such a dichotomy in what's supposed to be a secular state in that sense, where freedom of religion is supposed to be one of the foundational values of the society. They are allowing this religious doctrine to dominate over those who do not adhere to it. And they can even exercise some very brutal punishments of like beatings, cutting off hands. I mean, you name it. Like it is a very difficult, very difficult situation for the church to be living in.
Matthias, I've heard it said of Nigeria that for Christians, it is veritably a hell on earth. I mean, that's just a frightful reality. It's beyond my conception. It's my privilege to bring forth to help raise awareness, and yet it's still beyond my conception.
It's absolutely hell on earth. In fact, a lot of my colleagues and friends have called it, this is the burial ground. This is the body ground of how much death and suffering there is within the Christian community in Nigeria. And you will hear arguments, people saying it's because of, you know, tribal and ethnic conflict. It's because of so and this and that and the other thing. But you won't hear too often then cite the religious reasons behind this. And I'm telling you, and we're telling the world, religion may not be the sole cause of it, or faith may not be the sole cause of it, but it is a huge contributor to the violence.
Well, you know what I've discovered over the years, Matthias, the academic and the community, the leading figures of media, we've discovered that apart from any increasingly less than latent hostility, over the years they simply were disengaged. I think even Tom Brokaw at one point acknowledged, "I wish that we had learned more of organized religion and religious faith than we had." As a matter of fact, as an old movie buff, I purchased a biography of Greer Garson. She was in a wonderful film with Walter Pidgeon called Mrs. Miniver. It's one of the great iconic films of the 40s. A wonderful biography, and I wanted to read about her religiosity because she was a devout Presbyterian. The book had nothing to say about her religiosity. There wasn't even anything in the index because the author didn't care two whits. And I think when you read about and hear about tribal and social causes, they're statements that are grounded in ignorance, pure and simple.
The West ignores a huge piece of what it means to have faith around the world. The West seems to have this post-Christian, post-religion. I don't even want to call it post, but that's kind of the mentality they bring in. And they assume that that is not a contributing factor in anything in life. But when you travel in these regions and you visit with the folks and the people, faith is a huge part of everyday life. And I think as Westerners, when we say that that's not an indicator or that's not a significant thing to take into calculation when we're crafting policy or when we're thinking through the problems, we're missing a huge piece of the pie, a huge piece of what can really solve problems. And rest of the world cares deeply about faith. And Christians, they you bet your bottom dollar, they care about their faith a great deal.
You know, Father Copleston was a wonderful, I'm assuming he was Jesuit. He was an historian of philosophy as well as a Jesuit priest. And he has a phrase in his multi-volume History of Philosophy, and I love it. I wish I came up with it or coined it. He speaks of our powers of intellection. And what I have found is that the powers of intellection, no matter how formidably intellectual they may be, can also parlay into sheer stupidity and myopia, you know, truly. And you see this playing out. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand that religion, here in the West, we're actually an aberration, aren't we? We have minimized what throughout all of history has been maximized. You know,
I think we see that intellectual stupidity all too often, unfortunately.
Exactly. From time to time, to quote the inestimable Mo Howard, you will encounter intelligent imbeciles, you know. But that's an entirely different breed. Mattias, tell us, I mean, where else on the planet even comes close to rivaling Nigeria for Christians?
Well, something that also kind of goes kind of below the radar is a country in South Asia that we've all heard of, India. Yeah. India's persecution is absolutely on the rise. And some issues that I would maybe draw some attention to, particularly for the Christians, is there's, I believe, 9 out of the 28 or 29 states of India that have what's known as anti-conversion laws. And these anti-conversion laws are distinctly geared towards the religious minorities, which includes obviously Christians, and essentially criminalizes any conversion out of Hinduism into any other religion. But these, because, you know, as Christians, we evangelize, we share the gospel, we're the ones who are out on the streets, we share our faith with folks, we are the ones that are especially targeted by these. And they use the Hindu extremist factions that are behind these laws, use these bogus stories of like criminal mass conversions and inducement methods that Christians try to use to get people to come to know Jesus, when it's all in reality is just sharing the gospel. And if people want to, and the Constitution of India guarantees freedom of religion to propagate and to choose your religion and leave your religion, if you will, if you want to. And these laws run completely counter to what the constitutional provisions provide for the whole country. You know, I'm bringing the advocacy angle to it, but in the spiritual angle, this is obviously a complete attack on just the success of the gospel in the country.
Mattias, I was over in India. I had the privilege of going over several years in a row in the late 90s to do some teaching at a place called the Hindustan Bible Institute in Chennai. Then it was still called Madras. And I arrived that first year, 97, right in the immediate aftermath, and you'll know of whom I speak, the murder of Bishop Staines and his two boys. Yeah. I got there right after that happened, and you could feel it in the air. Yeah. And then the next year I was over, I was with a young student. We had got left the confines of the campus. We went out into the town, and all of a sudden, this noise just took over, and a group of Hindu radicals were riding through town demanding that every shop be shut down in protest of the arrest of one of their own. And the young man with me, who came in from another area of India, I could see on his face he was frightened beyond measure. Beyond measure. He couldn't wait to get back into the confines of the campus. And my friends now who minister in the south of India, which is historically safe for believers, they're beginning to feel tension in the air as well. It's just a frightful, frightful thing. But Matthias, I have to be very mindful of time. And so we're going to close out this segment. And we have one more. And you know there'll be many more down the road. Brad Lacey and Matthias Pertula of International Christian Concern. We will return for one final round in a moment. Thank you. Brad Lacey with Matthias Pertula, the Advocacy Director for Southeast Asia on behalf of International Christian Concern, a ministry of lobbying and practical support to the persecuted Christians around the globe. Matthias, we've been sharing about what's happening in Afghanistan, in Nigeria, and in India. But ICC, or International Christian Concern, has its eyes and ears everywhere. You're like the Lloyds of London on behalf of the Christian Church. And when I first became aware of ICC, it probably pushing 20 years now, I became so inordinately impressed by the quality. I know how you pair costs down to get as much material and the like into the field and less and less in the office, which is still an important thing. Tell us about the ministry of ICC. Last time, I think we got cut off. Something had taken over our attention. Let's hear more about International Christian Concern.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've been around since 1995, and actually in our inception, we were founded as a purely advocacy organization. So really just focused on the policy side of promoting religious freedom in countries, especially for Christians, obviously. In countries where that where religious freedom's in decline and where the church is really being persecuted. But since then, we evolved quite a lot. We got into a spot where we started to really realize the need that persecuted communities need. I mean, practical needs. They need finances, they need food, they need medical assistance, lawyers, they need all kinds of different things when they're being persecuted. So we began to fill that void in that space and started to support victims through financial means or whatever the need might be. Anything from really micro level projects, simple as buying groceries for someone or maybe getting them into a hotel for a week or two or something. Then we've evolved into some major macro level projects where we redevelop whole communities. We invest into agricultural projects for Christians that have been driven off their lands, that were farmers, maybe they raised chickens or they were in some sort of other industry, and we want to rebuild those industries in those communities so they can get their lives back together, and obviously rebuild churches, get Bibles into people's hands where we can, do some ministry work as well. We had this great program called Bikes and Bibles where we empower pastors across India to go around and pass Bibles and do a lot of on like straight ministry work for folks. And then obviously the awareness piece is huge. We have to tell the stories. That's the biggest thing. And we feel like that so much of the Western church is unaware or doesn't understand like the real difficulties that the church is going through. And I think the more that the church becomes aware, the more they're going to want to participate. They're going to want to support the church. They want to pray for them. They'll want to participate in some way to help our brothers and sisters around the world. So that's kind of the mission in a nutshell there.
Matthias, have you found over the course of time, has ICC found that with time, that that the Western churches, maybe not everyone, maybe not even the majority, but have you seen an increase in interest and awareness?
I think there's a steady increase, little by little. And I think that as, you know, persecution and, you know, when we start to see religious freedom even being threatened in a Western context, I think that awakens people in many ways to kind of see that, yeah, maybe we need to be paying more attention to this, that we, that some of the freedoms that we have here are so precious, and if they can be taken away so easily around the world, is this country any different? I hope to God it is. But even now we see trends across the West, Europe, and even into US, where incrementally there are some segments that are moving in and trying to take away our religious freedom.
You know, I was listening to a radio talk program this morning, and they were talking about the fact that never before have we seen such an, at a local level, such an intense investment in what's happening. And so that would spell, even amongst the Christian church, that would suggest a positive counter thrust, if you would. We have to be mindful, of course, you and I, as the Apostle Paul puts it, that the weapons that we have at our disposal are not carnal. We have the Word of God and we have prayer. And I might add, we have the agape, the love of Christ. It's the most powerful commodity in the history of creation, you know. Yeah. Matthias, tell me and tell us, who amongst the American government, who amongst the Brits, where do you find and with whom do you find genuine, concrete interest, a desire to help these beleaguered brethren of ours?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, there's a number of senators and congressmen that are highly invested in this issue. Senator Lankford is probably,
yes, I've heard,
Oklahoma.
Yeah.
He's an excellent champion in this space. Representative Chris Smith of New Jersey is another champion on religious freedom. Ever since he came to Congress in the 80s, this has been one of his core issues. Frank Wolf, he was in Virginia, I believe it was the 5th District. He has since retired, but he's really the one of the kind of leading figures of international religious freedom. They're all Republicans, but on the Democrat side, what we've seen, folks like Jim McGovern of Massachusetts, Jamie Raskin of Maryland, they've all championed legislation and pieces that have impacted religious freedom and kind of safeguarded in a very bipartisan way U.S. kind of interest in terms of religious freedom.
Well, Matthias, coming as I do from what we have been wont to call the People's Republic of Massachusetts, you've given me hope that there is some clarity amongst politicians in Massachusetts. Okay. You know, how about, I don't even know if he's still around, but Lord David Alton from the House of Lords. Have you dealt with him at all?
Oh yeah, he's great.
Yep.
We love
have
Lord David
him?
Alton. Oh yeah,
you
yeah.
Have.
He's a fantastic guy. We absolutely love his work and continue to support him and believe, support him, advise wherever we can, and we love what the Brits are doing.
Matthias, I want you to know I have a very dear friend of 42 years standing who was doing some exquisite work in Thailand, up in Chiang Mai, ministering to the young women coming out of the sex trafficking industry.
Yeah,
Lord David Alton visited them on their site, and he invited my lovely friend. And if she's listening, she'll get a kick out of this. She invited my lovely friend to address a select committee of the House of Lords in London.
Yeah.
And my friend had to turn him down because her schedule wouldn't allow for it.
Oh,
and
boy.
I thought to myself, I don't care if you're getting married. You postpone. You're invited to speak before the House of Lords.
I think I would have said the same thing.
Yeah. Now, he works, of course, with Jubilee Campaign.
Yeah, sure.
He's a devout Catholic believer. And you have met him. Oh, I'm envious.
Yeah.
I'm envious. Praise. Well, he's met you as well, by the way. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm told.
That is, you know you're going to be invited back. It's always a joy. But we are out of time. You and I want nothing but the best for our persecuted believers. The fact that we could have this moment To raise awareness is a great privilege. Praise God. Brad Lacey and Matthias Pertula of International Christian Concern, we bid you God's blessing in every way. Take care.